do here? Is that what I'm going to be talking with them about?
Yeah.
Thank you. That's it.
Call the House Committee on Health Care to order. And let me give you a little preview of what we're going to do. First of all, we are not going to hear anything today or work anything today on House Bill 2009. We're going to be focusing on three bills. We're going to start testimony on, I'm going to open up a public hearing on 2468 and on 2376. We're going to hear the first three testifiers, which will include me and Representative Tomei and Senator Bates, assuming he gets here in time for that. And then we'll recess that public hearing and open up a work session, a brief work session, or a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 160, which I expect will be very quick. In fact, it needs to be very quick, so we'll make sure it's very quick. And and then I intend to pass that bill, assuming everything goes well. But I'd like that to take no more than 15 minutes. I do want to announce, Cindy, do you want to talk about the bill we're bringing back?
Oh, sure, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is just an announcement. On Friday, we passed Senate Bill 155 out of the committee, which was the bill that was allowing DHS to appoint a medical director to the three facilities that we have, and I can't rattle those off the top of my head. DHS received word that the bill in its current form has an issue from their AG, so we have submitted corrective language for that bill. So we will be bringing that bill back on Wednesday for possible reconsideration. So don't be alarmed when you see that on Wednesday.
Okay, and when we're talking about House Bill 2376, we have a gut and stuff amendment in front of all of you. We'll be talking about 2376 in the amended form. So is that right?
That's right.
The amended form. So let's let me open up a public hearing on House Bill 2468 and on House Bill 2376. And you want to start?
I will do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Carolyn Tomei. I'm state representative from House District 41, and it's a pleasure to be in front of you today to be testify in support of House Bill 2376-2 amendment, which, as the good chair mentioned, is a gut and stuff. It's our bill that deals with pharma gifting. Citizens today are acutely aware of the pharmaceuticals industry's effort to market prescription drugs directly to the consumer. We see gorgeous, expensively produced ads on television showing beautiful, happy, excited people extolling the virtues of a new, expensive drug. We see beautiful, slick, full-page ads in magazines and newspapers. So citizens are very aware of the huge ad campaigns that pharmaceutical companies use to market new, expensive drugs to us, direct to the consumer. What we're not aware of is that these same pharmaceutical companies spend, look at my hand here, colleagues, five times that much on marketing to the very people who write these prescriptions for us, doctors, nurses, and other medical professions. Pharmaceutical companies spend an estimated $57 billion on marketing, twice as much as they do on research and development of new drugs. That is a lot of money. Also, about 94% of doctors have admitted to accepting some form of gifts or money. By law, we as elected officials must be absolutely transparent in disclosing any gift or contribution we receive as elected officials, the nature of the gift, the amount, the date, the contributor. And that is a good law. It shows our constituents who gives us money or gifts, and that they can compare that with how we vote on issues that are important to them. Anyone in our state can get on the Internet and see up-to-date information on our contributions and expenditures. House Bill 2376-2 The bill we bring to you today holds the pharmaceutical and medical device industries to the same strict standards to which we as legislators must abide. This bill is only a disclosure bill. It does not forbid any of these practices. It only requires transparency. It would require pharmaceutical and medical device companies to submit an annual report to the Oregon Department of Justice disclosing gifts and payments to physicians, hospitals, pharmacists, and other healthcare professionals. The bill does not include drug samples intended for patients, gifts valued at $100 or less, or educational materials that directly benefit patients or are intended for patient use. Doesn't the public have the right to know if their prescriber might be influenced by the promotional efforts of a pharmaceutical or medical device company? Committee, one of the tasks this session, and most especially the task of this committee, is to bring down health care costs so that more people can have adequate, affordable health care. We know that one of the biggest cost drivers is the high cost of prescription drugs. Drug spending in the United States has increased over 18% each and every year. Direct marketing to medical professionals contributes to the rising costs of prescription drugs in two ways. First, the huge marketing campaign aimed at those professionals increases the pharmaceutical costs of producing the drugs. And second, this marketing directly encourages doctors to prescribe the newest, most expensive drugs, many having only marginal benefits over existing options with the established safety records. We have only to look at Bextra and Vioxx. These drugs were marketed heavily and were very expensive. They were later found to have dangerous side effects, were taken off the market, and found to be no more effective than aspirin or acetaminophen. These intense marketing practices benefit only the pharmaceutical industry. Doctors already have independent, reliable resources to learn about the efficacy of new medications. Patients need to be able to trust that their doctors have not been unduly influenced by the strong promotional efforts of the pharmaceutical companies. It's time for these companies to become transparent in their marketing practices. During this current economic crisis, it makes sense to pass laws that will benefit the public and shine a light on those practices of pharmaceutical and medical device manufacturers that might influence our medical professionals' decisions. You may hear that the information required by this legislation is proprietary. I say that anything that affects the health of me and of my family should be open and transparent. It's time to take a stand against marketing tactics that increase healthcare costs and provide no benefits to patients. We have a chance to do exactly that while creating transparency with House Bill 2376, and I urge you to send a strong message by moving this bill forward with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was involved in a major research project called the Systolic Hypertension in the Elderly Project, and it was
Representative Greenlee. Could
excuse
you please
me,
introduce
please.
Yourself?
Excuse me.
Ooh. Yes.
High fives all around.
Excuse us, Mr. Chair. The rest of us will not applaud, please.
Somebody help me with my name. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlee, House District 33, representing Northwest Portland all the way to North Plains in historic Tualatin County. I was one of the original investigators in a large national multicenter clinical trial that looked at the question of whether systolic hypertension in the elderly should be treated. Systolic hypertension is the top number, and typically in aging, that top number goes up without the diastolic going up. And there was a lot of theory that that was a good thing, that that was nature's way of pushing blood through the brain to make sure the brain could continue to function. So it was a sort of interesting question of whether treating that systolic hypertension would reduce heart attacks and strokes. And we had a multicenter clinical trial, a fairly expensive clinical trial, and actually stopped the trial early because it was clear that treating systolic hypertension would reduce strokes and heart attacks by more than 25% in the elderly. And I remember having the press conference, and since I had some involvement on the economic side of healthcare, we had a national press conference, and one of the questions was, how much would it cost to treat a patient using the drugs we were using, which was hydrochlorothiazide and chlorothalidone, if we treated people? And the answer is, we could treat a patient on that on either of those drugs for about $15 a year. And therefore, since this was a disease that hit a very large proportion of the elderly, we could treat it using those drugs well within the cost of our medical care and save a lot of hospitalization for strokes and such. The week after the trial results were published in JAMA, and I think that's where they were published, the journals were full of ads for how important this trial was and for drugs that were not the drugs we had used in the trial. They were for ACE inhibitors, they were for calcium channel blockers, they were for beta blockers. They were for drugs that rather than costing $20 a year could cost $20 a month or $20 a week in some cases. And what happened is, while our investigators started going out on the routine talking to physicians about systolic hypertension in the elderly, doctors who were involved with drug companies, even though they were university professors, were out talking about the results of the trial, but glossing over what drugs had achieved the results, and we're talking about the drugs that they had contractual relationships with the drug companies to work with, either in their own research or as consultants. And nobody knew that were listening to those doctors that they were not giving their just basic free opinion as medical school faculty or as hypertension experts. That really led me at that point, which now is about 20 years ago, to recognize we have to find a way that makes public the relationships between doctors and drug companies in order to be able to assess, either as patients or as other professionals listening to their lectures, in order to assess the extent to which their opinion and their advice is independent or the extent to which it's biased because of a relationship they have with the pharmaceutical manufacturer. You have two bills in front of you today that take two different approaches to dealing with this problem, both of which we're sponsors of. One, 2468 is patterned after a very successful law in the state of Minnesota that creates this kind of disclosure model. The other bill, 2376, is patterned after a proposed national law that would provide this same kind of regulation at the national level. The one bill uses the Board of Pharmacy to manage this process. The other bill uses the Department of Justice. But both of them get us where we want to go. Both of them make public the relationships between drug companies and physicians, and both of them in many ways really simply enforce what the drug companies say that they've been doing now as a result of other things that are going on in the pharmaceutical industry. These are both serious bills. One has a subsequent referral, one doesn't. There are pieces of both bills that are useful, and we might try and find a way to amend parts of one into the other to achieve what it is we're trying to achieve. There are already two amendments proposed for 2468, one that makes clear that samples are not a compensation model, and another one that talks about that gives the Board of Pharmacy the ability to create fees to help pay for the performance of their duties. But this is something that we really need to move to. The issues of making these things open and public is very important and very timely, and I hope we will find a way to move through the thicket that gets these bills out of the committee, through the House, through the Senate, and to the governor's desk.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now that you know who I am.
Yes. Senator Bates.
Vice Chair Maurer and committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm sorry I came in a few minutes late, but we got tied up on a railroad issue in Southern Oregon, of all things, so I'll jump trails here. I hope I'm on the correct bill.
Your name.
For the record, I'm Senator. I'm getting there. For the record, I'm Senator Alan Bates, District 3, Southern Oregon. I want to give you a little bit of history about myself first before I say anything about these two bills, because it's part of a history you probably haven't heard from me before. Before I was a physician, I worked for a pharmaceutical company, Park Davis. Shocking, I know. People are still wondering about that. I worked for them for almost 5 years, and those times you were called a detail person. You detailed drugs, and at that time, we didn't have a single dollar for expenses, except for our own personal expenses. We didn't take doctors out for dinners or lunches. We gave them samples. We carefully detailed them on drugs. Sometimes we would actually be trained well enough that on that particular drug, we might know more about it than the physician would, and we were expected to. When I first broke into that industry, about half of the people who were doing the detailing were actually pharmacists. Eli Lilly is an example. Until the 1970s, wouldn't accept anybody to do detailing except a pharmacist. Those of us who weren't pharmacists had to have completed our undergraduate work in preparing for medical school. And other than that, you just about couldn't get a job with a pharmaceutical company in those days. So when we went out the field, there were very few of us. We would sit down with a physician. We'd often give him samples of any new medications that were available, and we would spend a significant time trying to detail them on those drugs, the side effects, reactions of the drugs, the effect of the drug themselves, and the clinical trials those drugs had been through in order to understand what the drug had been brought forward for. Things have changed a lot in those last 30 years, unfortunately. It's now a marketing. There are probably 10 times as many representatives as there were during my time, and a great deal of their time is spent simply trying to get access to physicians. I detailed about 50 drugs. Most of these people now detail one or two drugs. And it's led to situations which many physicians now feel very uncomfortable with, and that's what these bills speak to. There's still some very appropriate things going on. Obviously, sampling new medications is appropriate. Detailing those drugs carefully is also appropriate. And I think giving honoraria for physicians who are leaders in the field to come and talk to other physicians and give a lecture about that's also appropriate. I've many times been at lectures where the individual standing in front of us was from a major medical center who had worked in that field for a long time. And in the last 4 or 5 years, they now declare and must declare their conflict potentially. They tell you what company sponsored them, and they tell you what drug might be involved in the lecture they're going to give you on a particular field of medicine. Having said that, it still needs to be more transparent, and that's what these bills do. It doesn't prevent that from happening. It allows it to be more transparent, not only to the public, but frankly, to other physicians. I have also still some grave concerns about the marketing tools that are still used by much of the industry. I'm particularly concerned about rather massive free lunches handed out to doctors' offices and in fact, trying to get access to physicians leads to a lot of problems in the offices sometimes with who gets the lunch, who doesn't get the lunch. And you can't believe how much people fight over these things. I'd like to see that kind of thing eliminated entirely. There are some clinical trials that go on that are questionable. Phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials are absolutely what needs to be done. Some of the fourth stage clinical trials done in more in the public domain sometimes are more of a marketing tool than a true clinical trial. Now, the only thing I'm actually concerned about in these bills is the $100 limit on an annual basis per physician, as I understand the language. That actually might be a little low. There are times when you actually ask for information that might require more than that. I commonly will have a reaction to a drug or a concern about a drug, and we'll give the specific questions to the drug representative. He sends them back to his company. They research it with their physicians, and you get a letter back or literature back later explaining that situation. And that could pretty easily go over $100 pretty quickly. That's very legitimate. It's just sort of a cumbersome thing to have to keep reporting at that low level. I'd like to see that raised up probably to $250, something of that nature, so that we're not encumbering a good process, but at the same time making this much more transparent, which really does need to happen. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony unless you have questions. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Kinnaman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, the question, it's $100 per calendar year in the bill, or in the draft dash 2. You're talking nearly that in some instances. Am I understanding you correctly?
It could run into that. If they actually had to calculate what the cost was for doing that, I'm afraid it might run over $100. Yep. Especially as we're seeing now, thank goodness, that representatives are picking up 7, 8, 9 drugs they're detailing on, not just the one or two. It could be a problem.
And not
a problem from the point of view they couldn't do it. It's just more paperwork to get done.
I don't think what you just discussed falls under the definition of compensation. So I think we define compensation certainly in 2376 in a much clearer way that would, I think, exclude what it is you just suggested.
If that's excluded, it wouldn't be a problem. If you're talking about pure gifts, that's something else. I just was reading it over the weekend. I was like a little concerned there. Okay.
Representative Brewer?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Bates, you're the perfect witness for this. You're the perfect witness for this. And my question is this. I didn't know that about your history prior to you being a physician.
You still respect me in the morning.
I absolutely do. Absolutely do. Not changed at all. My question is, and not to lead it, but my impression is that it was a much simpler time. In those years, in a much more complex time in the medical world now. And I guess my question is this. Back then, when you were doing it, prior to your career as a physician, even though it was only one-tenth of, if you will, the pharmaceutical sales staff, and they didn't have all the tools of marketing and that they use now, was it easier to gain access to a physician than it is now? And my sense, I'm not trying to lead you, but my sense is the way we, and it's part of what we're discussing with 2009, it's difficult to get in to see a physician for longer than 10 or 15 minutes. I don't think it was always the case. I don't think that was always the case. And my sense is it's much more difficult, hence the tools that these companies now use to get to see a physician, because the old model, based in a different era, doesn't work anymore.
Mr. Vice Chair,
you tell me.
Yeah, Mr. Bruce. Representative Brune, the old model worked well. What changed it, frankly, was one drug. That drug was the one called Zantac, and most people never heard of Zantac, or if you have, it doesn't really register your mind. A drug came out just prior to Zantac called Tagamet, which was a huge breakthrough in the treatment of ulcers for the stomach. And up to that time, generally speaking, the process worked the way I said it did. Zantac came out. It was a drug that was marginally better than Tagamet, slightly better. And the company that had it decided they were going to try something new. They were going to try blitzing the doctor's offices on Zantac and see if they could get market share out of this thing, because Tagamet had been out for a year or so and had about 90% of the market share. And it worked. They just hammered doctor's offices with samples, taking them places, taking them out for dinner, doing all kinds of things. And within a year or two, they had over half the market share. And don't hold me these figures. I could go back and research them for you. That changed how we dealt with pharmaceuticals. From that point on, when a new drug came out, marketing was a huge issue. The number of representatives exploded. You no longer had one representative covering 40 or 50 drugs. You had each representative with only one drug. As an example, in the territory I used to have, there were about 15 or 16 of us going around talking to physicians. That same territory now has 150. and that's not an exaggeration. You're going to find, however, in the field that it's retracting again. Huge layoffs in the industry as these blockbuster drugs become generic. And we're going back more to the old model. And frankly, I think the old model was a better model and one that will still work. You'll never go all the way back to it and probably shouldn't. But as the number of representatives drop down and as the pressure on physicians, drops down, and this becomes more transparent, I think you'll see more offices opening up to representatives again.
Well, can I follow up with that? I
speed things up. Huh?
What's that?
I think we need to speed things up.
I guess my question is it harder to, in the pharmaceutical rep industry, if you will, is it harder to access a physician's office now because it's so much more competitive? You're, instead of competing against 10 or 12 other pharmaceutical reps, you're competing against, as you mentioned, 150. Is that what's driving the difference? Or is it truly, I guess the question I ultimately want to know, is there less time devoted by the physicians to learning about new drugs than there was in however many years, was that 20 years ago? I'm not sure.
Well, thank you. You're very gentle.
It's only 10, right?
Before the invention of electricity.
Yeah.
the question is simply, is it the same amount of time?
That's true. No, you're right. The access problem is primarily because of the huge number of representatives. Drug representatives. And that is absolutely the cause, I believe, of this. If there were fewer and you only see one a day, you'd have plenty of time to see everybody.
Okay. Has one a day always been the norm?
It varies from physician to physician and office to office, but if you had 15 in your territory, you'd probably be seeing one or two or three a week, and that'd give you plenty of time to see them and have a good discussion.
Thank you, Doctor. Okay.
I think we have about 30 witnesses coming. Oh, so
okay. Okay.
Representative Thompson.
Jim is our expert in this area.
I have participated in a number of phases of this problem over the years, I have to admit. More than one CE program at a ski resort. You remember the old days when that went on.
Yes.
That money is long gone. One of the questions, I understand where you want the bill to go, but I'm not convinced that we're there. How does reporting this to the state accomplish anything for John Q. Public? And secondly, what's that going to cost the state to do that? I guess my concern is we're going to set up a data reporting system, you know, a data accumulation system, maybe a website, but does that really overpower television advertising and everything that's going on if there isn't some kind of an outreach education to John Q. Public that's going to cost somebody some money to do? Will the general public individually actually go to, let's say, for instance, a website and check and see if their doctor has taken any money from Brand X Pharmaceutical Company on such and such a drug that they've been prescribed? I can't complete the circle here. I know what you're getting at, but I'm not sure if we do it with this approach.
Mr. Chair and Representative Thompson, I'll try to answer the question. This is strictly on my own knowledge, and I can't guarantee this
briefly,
is the right
please,
answer.
Briefly, please,
Senator. Yes, Chair. I think some people will. I've been pretty impressed by my patients going to websites and asking me questions in my office these days that I have to be on my toes for, and sometimes they let me go check that. I believe that advocates and certain patients will go look at those. It will expose it. It will make some of us physicians think twice before we accept certain types of remuneration. Okay? I think honorariums are fine, but I think you have to be careful with the rest of it. Yeah, I think there's real value to getting out on a website. I'm impressed by how often people use it.
Representative Toomey here. That's an excellent question, Representative. And I think we will be addressing that a little bit further. We'll have quite a few people who are testifying.
Okay.
So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You both. Thanks for coming, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to recess the public hearing on 2468 and 2376, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 160. I'm going to trade staff here for a moment. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And you can call Jane out.
Is your bill versus mine? Rox, can you tell us what this bill is about, please?
Yes. Very briefly, currently Oregon law requires that you have prior consent before HIV testing. State law allows three exceptions to that. This bill would create a fourth. It would require Department of Human Services, DHS, to establish procedures whereby they could do HIV testing in the three state hospitals on patients that cannot give informed consent, and the bill would become effective immediately upon passage.
May I call Swidens, please?
Sorry.
Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, my name is Jane Ellen Whitehands. I'm the Governmental Affairs Manager for Addictions and Mental Health Division. Thanks for allowing me to testify before you today.
Of Department of Public Health.
Department of Human Services.
I mean Human Services.
Yes, Department of Human Services. Didn't I say that? I'm sorry. Addictions and Mental Health Division. Addictions and Mental Health Division is the division that the Oregon State Hospital and Blue Mountain Recovery Center are within our jurisdiction. And this bill basically does exactly what your committee administrator just says, is it gives us the authority to use our significant medical procedures process to test individuals who do not have capacity to give informed consent to test them for HIV. Oregon's law is very specific about HIV and informed consent, and this allows us to test those individuals while protecting their rights. This passed out of the Senate with no opposition. It's supported by AFSCME, SEIU, Cascade AIDS Project, and Disability Rights Oregon. So we'd appreciate your support as well today so we can test individuals for HIV and make sure that they get the treatment and services they need while they're under our care. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the frequency or how frequently do you think you might need to use this procedure?
Chair Greenlich, Representative Kenemer, at this time it's hard to determine. What happened is that we recently revised our process on significant medical procedures to use the administrative law judge process, and in that changeover to having a new process, the administrative law judges said that they didn't feel that we needed to use the significant medical procedure process for HIV. So at this point, we don't have a real good count, and because we had been testing individuals for HIV until recently.
Are there any other questions? Yes, Representative
Cannon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. How is the determination of incapable of informed consent made? Can you describe that? Is that something that applies in other circumstances as well?
Chair Greenlit and Representative Cannon, yes, we do use the same process for other medical procedures such as non-emergency surgeries and other significant medical procedures, so invasive medical procedures. And basically the staff at the Oregon State Hospital go through an entire process of determining if the person can give informed consent. If they don't believe that the individual can give informed consent, it then goes to an administrative law judge who is acting in a surrogate role for the individual. And it's one of the reasons why the process is, the number is a little hard to determine, is we have some people who have guardians and conservators, and we would go there first before going through this administrative law judge process.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
I understand what you're trying to do here, and obviously we're playing off patient personal rights against public interest, but has the ACLU weighed in on this? Seems like could be a really big issue.
Chair Greenlich, Representative Thompson, they haven't at this point weighed in. The bill was vetted through the Senate side, and they didn't testify at that point. Really, that one of the key things for us was making sure that the individuals in the HIV community and the AIDS advocates were invested and had a chance to look at the bill. We amended the bill on the Senate side to address their concerns. This is specifically limited to the Oregon State Hospital, Blue Mountain Recovery Center, and Eastern Oregon Training Center.
And basically, I assume this is for the benefit of the patient rather than for the benefit of society.
Chair Greenlech, you're exactly right. Many people with HIV, especially in active AIDS cases, end up with dementia or AIDS-induced psychosis. We need to know if that's what's causing the person's mental illness. We also want to make sure that the individual is getting appropriate treatment when they're under our care. We want to get them their antiretrovirals and the other drugs that will help them stabilize their condition.
Yes. Thank you. I appreciate the issue of the informed consent. What about voluntary consent? I mean, will this be done on an involuntary basis as needed, as long as it falls under the definition of informed consent?
Chair Greenlech, Representative Bruin, for individuals who can perform or have the capacity to give informed consent, if they don't want to be tested, we will not test them. Good answer.
That doesn't quite get to the answer of the
I'm sorry.
Of the people we're talking about. That's the current population, informed consent. We're talking about people who don't have the ability, for whatever reason, to give informed consent.
Correct.
Right.
So we do have people at the state hospital who have been determined to have the ability to give informed consent for medical procedures, including HIV testing. So we ask them if they want to have this done or not, and if they say no, then we don't do that. If we believe, as an example, someone with advanced dementia in our neuropsych wards can't give informed consent, that's who we're going to. Yeah. So it's specifically a subset of our population at the state hospital.
But my question is, it could still be voluntary or involuntary, or be determined as voluntary or involuntary at that point. A person may not be able to give informed consent, but the person could know, I assume we're talking blood tests, we're talking, you know, a withdrawing blood. You still have an issue of somebody saying okay or reacting in a fashion that accepts that or reacting in a fashion that doesn't accept that. And my question is, if the person is reacting in a fashion that doesn't accept that, will you do it anyway?
Chair Greenlech and Representative Bruin.
Bottom line, is the person constrained and the test is given regardless of the
It
situation.
Is possible that we would be testing individuals who, for whatever reason, have rejected the test and don't want to have the test happening to them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill... Where are we? 160? On Senate Bill 160 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 160. Can I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 160 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Harker moves Senate Bill 160 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Bruin, you had something on your mind?
Well, I did, and I'm not sure. It's not a point necessarily to oppose the bill. I don't oppose the bill. I want to make sure that was clear what we're talking about, because we're going to be talking in situations. I'm certainly no expert on mental health care treatment and the phenomenal challenges and, frankly, the Lord's work that people who do that kind of treatment engage in. I just want to make it clear that we're talking situations where a person that may not be in possession of full decision-making ability may still resist this or any other number of treatments or tests.
Yeah, so doesn't know specifically what they're doing, but they don't want that person with the needle coming near.
Right.
Yeah, I think that is the case. I think that will be involuntary in that case.
Mr. Chair, I really appreciate Representative Bruin's questioning on this point. This is an area, obviously, for us to act, I think, with extreme caution. And again, I'm not a no either, but I think as we... certainly if we're faced with these kinds of policy questions related to people who cannot speak for themselves and related to medical procedures, interventions that they may somehow react negatively to, just be aware that we hopefully don't take this step lightly. So again, I'm there for the bill, but with that sort of note of caution.
I think that's kind of my concern, too, because it hasn't been that long ago, particularly in the field of mental health, that we allowed government to make decisions on the behalf of patients who had no voice for the good of the patient, and it turned out, in sterilization and some of the other issues, not to be such a really good idea. I hope we're not moving back to a slippery slope where we're going to go back into something like that where we'll start deciding what's best for patients without third-party review. I'm going to support this, but I think we need to be extremely cautious that we don't get into something we don't want to be in, not this one, but the next one.
Well, there is a process for third-party review for significant issues. I think this is just deemed not to be that, but I certainly agree, and it's a major issue in the mental health community around the question of taking drugs or not taking drugs for the patient. It's a huge issue. Okay. Would you call the roll, please, Laura?
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative
Gannon?
Aye. Representative Dembrough?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative
Henemer? Aye.
Representative
Kozak?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion passes. I have a volunteer to carry it. I'll do it. Green the carrier. Okay, close the work session at Senate Bill 160 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2468 and 2376. And I'll have the list in front of me in a minute. I'm going to ask you all, there are a very large number of people. We have to be done at 5 for sure, because we have other business both at 5 and some of us at 5:30. So I ask you to sort of hold your testimony to 3 minutes, if you possibly can. And we'll start with Dr. Bob Sack, Dr. Martin Donahue. Is Dr. Dave Pass here? Is that? I have a question mark. Oh, yeah. You gonna do that? You're going to be together? Okay. We'll wait till the next one. Let us get up. No. How about Mark Halpin? Mark, are you here? There you are. Come on, why don't you join this group, and then we'll have Dr. Smith and Pass from the Oregon Health Resources group next. Glad to see all of my favorite colleagues from OHSU here today. You pick the order.
I guess my name was mentioned first, so I'll start off.
You also have seniority for these youngsters.
I'm Bob Sack. I'm a retired professor of psychiatry at OHSU and formerly director of the sleep program there, sleep medicine program. In the interest of abbreviated testimony, I'm going to refer you to an article that I wrote for a magazine called Open Spaces. The title of it is The Marketing of Medicine to Doctors, and I've distributed that to you. And it makes many of the points that have already been raised by Dr. Greenlee and Dr. Tomei. One area that I would like to maybe draw to your attention as a possible somewhat difficult area, maybe a loophole, and that is the existence of the medical education communications companies. These are the intermediate companies that often sponsor essentially marketing events for physicians. They are for-profit companies with names like Phase 5 Communications, Health Education Technologies, etc. And in 1999, their revenues were estimated to be $1 billion, and that's probably out of date at this point. They sponsor various educational symposia by recruiting thought leaders from the field, and indeed I was one of those at one time, and the as the article says, this piece is somewhat of an apologetic one. But anyway, these companies get their money from drug companies, and respected researchers are given handsome honoraria to provide lectures and educational materials that, although not patently biased, are never unfriendly to the drug company that is behind the scenes sponsor. CME program regulations require that speakers reveal any financial arrangements from their sponsors, but by going through one of these companies, the drug company is able to obscure their linkage. What's missing in this arrangement is a healthy, adversarial, skeptical relationship between the academician, medical educator, researcher, and the corporate marketer. Instead, there's a gray zone in which the researcher-academician is not easily distinguished from the marketer. In other words, a great need for much more transparency in all of the aspects of this relationship. The medical marketplace is a fuzzy buyer-seller relationship. The doctor makes the decision about which drug to prescribe, ideally by being well-informed and keeping the patient's best interest in mind, but the doctor is not bearing the expense and may be quite unaware of the cost. The good patient tries to follow his doctor's instructions, whatever the cost. The sponsor may be bearing the majority of the expense, but can pass it back to the patient and the employer through insurance premiums. All the medical expenses are mixed together in the insurance premium, and the true cost of the drug is obscured. So this bill would help to raise consciousness of the degree to which marketing elevates the expense of current medications, and perhaps the informed patient will come to the doctor, as suggested by the television ads, and ask them about a certain drug, but maybe with a follow-up question, is there a less expensive alternative? Thank you.
Oh, good. Good job. Right on. Martin?
Yeah.
Hold on, Bob. I think there may be questions.
Representative Green, like the rest of the committee. My name is Martin Donahoe. I'm a physician. I practice internal medicine. I'm also an adjunct associate professor at PSU, where I teach courses in public health ethics, medical humanities, and human rights as it relates to women's health. I've been studying and lecturing on the pharmaceutical industry for about 15 years now, and actually gave a grand rounds at Stanford University 15 years ago to try to get physicians interested in getting a bill like this passed. So I think it's long overdue. Americans spend over $200 billion per year on pharmaceuticals. Spending on prescription drugs accounts in part for rising out-of-control health care costs. The U.S. is the only industrialized country not to regulate prescription drug prices, which helps to explain why drug prices here are 2 to 3 times greater than in other Western democracies. Such costs could be justified if profits were largely reinvested in research on new agents. However, drug companies spend more on advertising and marketing than on research and development. You heard $58 billion on marketing versus $30 billion on research and development. They specifically spend between $8,000 and $11,000 marketing to physicians. I have a bag with me that's somewhat embarrassing to share with you. These are things that were dropped off at my office over the last 20 years. Various gifts from drug companies, the Rhinocort Rhino, baby's first visit gift from Enfamil to discourage breastfeeding.
Where's your putter? You couldn't get that in that bag.
A Rubik's Cube, other stuffed animals, and a dog bone, and a Viagra tie. This from Aricept, a drug that's used for Alzheimer's patients, which tells you that your time is running out. There's a wealth of published peer-reviewed data that confirm that such marketing sadly does influence physicians' prescribing patterns and is frowned upon by patients. Interactions between physicians and drug company marketing representatives, which are very common, often entail gifts to physicians. Gifts both large and small have been shown in a number of studies to influence physicians' willingness to prescribe certain drugs and to make them less likely to prescribe cheaper, equally effective generic medications. Voluntary guidelines to limit such lavish gifts have been ineffective. extending their influence over medicine, drug companies have also increasingly set the research agendas of academic medical centers and provide the majority of financial support for the continuing medical education of physicians in the United States. Such support leads to publication bias, sponsored studies, suppressed data, and ghost-written editorials. House Bill 2376 is an important and common-sense piece of legislation. Patients should never have to wonder if their doctor's prescriptions were influenced by gifts of cash, food, or travel. Requiring all pharmaceutical manufacturing companies to disclose annually the value, nature, and purpose of gifts and other economic subsidies given to healthcare providers and institutions will help restore the credibility of the medical profession and the public's collective trust in medicine in general and in their physicians' prescribing practices in particular. This bill will help uphold the ethical standards that the public has a right to expect from the medical profession. Thank you.
Martin, thank you very much.
Can I ask after the...
Sure. Well, let's get... I just want to tell you, I have no intention of working either of these bills today, but I do want to open a work session on 2376 for the purpose of adopting the Dash 1 amendments into it, which... So we have the right bill in front of us as we consider it later.
All right, thank you. Dr. Halfen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I appreciate the chance to talk with you today. I'm Mark Helfand. I'm a professor of medicine at Oregon Health and Science University and a staff physician at the Portland VA. I'm also the director of the Oregon Evidence-Based Practice Center, a research organization that appraises clinical research evidence for clinicians and the public. But I speak just for myself today, not on behalf of OHSU or the EPC. Is there something?
No, if you just move a little closer, probably.
Closer to the mic? All right. My main interest, in fact, today is in protecting the integrity of the doctor-patient relationship. As a teacher of residents and students, I've seen patients upset because their physicians inadvertently advertise products on their stethoscopes, pen lights, and other tools. Seeing patients is a privilege, and a physician's primary responsibility is to their patients. The relationship is fiduciary, meaning that the patient must be able to trust that the physician's advice is unbiased. The lack of transparency has undermined trust in our profession. A couple of years ago, I had the opportunity of doing a workshop in Brooklyn, New York, at the School of Law there for federal judges. And we taught them about assessing clinical evidence. Of course, they're experts in assessing every other kind of evidence. They were very sharp. It was a great two-day workshop. But one of them stood up at some point while we were talking about some of the things that Martin mentioned. I wasn't talking about them. One of the other speakers was talking about those issues. And he said, you know, a physician used to be, when a physician walked into the courtroom, we were hushed. Everybody listened carefully. Everybody had sort of a tremendous presumption of respect. Now we think, who are they really working for? It was kind of a crushing moment for the physicians on the stage to sort of hear that from the federal judge's perspective. Lack of transparency much more evolved now. I'm sorry, disclosure is already the norm now in two other settings. In research, it's become clear that disclosure is essential. Research that has been done by groups like the Evidence-Based Practice Centers indicates that disclosure is important because funding sources can affect the research agenda, the choices, the decisions the investigators make about the choice of comparator, the dosages of the different drugs, the outcomes they measure, and whether and how to publish the results. And medical students, in another setting, want to know about the relationships that their teachers have in order to evaluate what they're being taught. Dr. Bates mentioned how at Grand Rounds and other sessions, it's normal now, it's the usual thing for the speaker to disclose any relationships so that people can evaluate the information they provide. If doctors want to know that to evaluate the information, patients deserve no less than these other audiences. And I believe disclosure will restore trust, not undermine it. Two more points about that. One, disclosure need not stigmatize physicians. There's legitimate reasons for industry relationships, particularly in research. But non-disclosure, acting as if there's something to hide, definitely stigmatizes us. Getting funds from pharma to find a cure for a disease could be seen as a plus. But if there's other relationships that can't be seen as a plus by patients, maybe they aren't, and surely they need to be disclosed. I'm going to, the other point I was going to make was about trade secrets, but if I've been 3 minutes, I can stop there.
Why don't you make that point quickly?
Briefly, there's legitimate concerns, but Vermont tried a trade secrets protection, and the results of that were reported in JAMA in December of 2008, and they were discouraging. The results were that a lot of activities that you wouldn't really think were the scenario in which protection of trade secrets might be essential or legitimate had been covered by it. And in other words, speaker bureau relationships, other things besides discovery research where the competition might actually get an edge by finding out about the trade secret. So such a provision, at least when it was used in the Vermont legislation, really didn't do what it was supposed to do. And second, it's a tiny proportion of all of these kinds of relationships. So if it needs special attention, fine, but it shouldn't be too broad at covering these others.
Yeah, I think there's an amendment in the dash ones on 2376 that cover that, I think, very neatly, specifically about research and holding that off for a couple of years. Okay, let's open it up to these gentlemen. Yes, sir.
Thank you. It seems to me that maybe the problem is not the pharmaceutical companies, that it's the physicians. Physicians have the power to say no, and the OMA could pass a resolution and say physicians should not accept gifts. And I think that would clearly solve the problem.
Well, it won't solve the problem that's in 2468, which is about the financial arrangements between them, not about gifts. I mean,
okay, well, then include disclosure. I mean, I guess what if physicians are telling us that it's the pharmaceutical companies that are bad, when in fact they have the power to say no.
Well, maybe you want to say...
And disclose.
I want to say one thing first about that. I'm not saying pharmaceutical companies are bad, and if it were up to me, businesses outside the drug and device industry and the medical supply industry, when physicians act as consultants to insurance companies or vendors of information systems, I'm for disclosure of that, too. I don't think there's anything special. I should add that if people have grants from the government and it concerns the effectiveness of different treatments, they should be disclosed as well, but they already are, if you get a federal grant. As far as the voluntary systems for physicians to disclose, the problem is that they're voluntary, and those of us who... may do what you say. Follow the guidance. Pharma has guidance already, and so do medical associations for this, but they're not always observed. So all of us get painted with the same brush when some people decide not to follow those voluntary guidelines.
Okay. But it's still back. It seems to me that this legislation could be written, substitute pharma and say physician. Physician will report.
Any relationship they have with pharma.
Yeah,
but it's easier to get 30 drug companies than 3,000 physicians reporting. But you're right, it could. Because the issue is the...
My brother-in-law has to report that I'm related.
No, your brother-in-law. You have to report about your dopey brother-in-law.
That I have a brother-in-law.
Yeah.
But
no,
the point
I think your point is good, because I think the disclosure issue is about that joint relationship. How... And the purpose of the bill is to find a legitimate way to get that exposed. You're absolutely right. I don't take campaign contributions from certain people, and I make that known. You probably don't as well from certain people. I mean, it's just...
No, they just don't give me money.
If I might just add something, Representative Greenlick, I don't know what the numbers are for the Oregon Medical Association, but I can tell you that only about 43% of American physicians are members of the AMA, so the numbers might be similar. And physicians aren't held to the pronouncements of the AMA or the OMA, whether or not they're members. So while I'm all in favor of voluntary guidelines like the AMA has, I think that is not enough, clearly, as Dr. Helfand said. And having physicians report, again, I think would be quite an onerous burden to the state and add some degree of burden to physician. Now, it wouldn't add any to me personally, but I can imagine those who get multiple research grants or other funding, it would be very hard to police. I think it's much easier to police, as Mitch said, 30 drug companies than it would be to police that many doctors.
Okay. Thank you all very much. Here's the plan. I'm going to now call Dr. Janine Smith and Dr. Dave Pass. Are there only the two of you? After that, I'm going to call Keith Dubinarich from the Department of Justice. And after that, I'm going to call Jim Gardner and Tom Holt.
Chair Greenlink and members of the committee, I am Janine Smith, the Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, and I'm accompanied by Dr. David Pass, the Director of the Health Resources Commission. We were asked to present some background information about a couple things our office is doing, just to kind of set some context around this bill. As we all know, that pharmaceutical spending is one of the an ever-increasing portion of our health care spending. In your packet is a fact sheet. First one is just a one two-sider on the Health Resources Commission, which has been in existence since the early days of the Oregon Health Plan and has been doing evidence-based reviews of pharmaceutical drugs and medical technology assessments. We work closely with Dr. Helfand at OHSU's Evidence-Based Practice Center, and I believe you're going to hear from Mark Gibson later, who from the Center for Evidence-Based Policy, just to be confused about two different OHSU groups, but they do great work, and we partner with several other states in order to get these evidence-based reviews done and then use them both in the pharmaceutical arena as well as in medical technology arena. They're used by the Medicaid program as well as in some portion in the prescription drug program and the Public Employees Benefit Board. But more, what I wanted to draw your attention to was really the second fact sheet, which is a grant that my office has had for the last couple of years. We were one of 24 first-round recipients from the Attorney General Consumer and Prescriber Education Grant Program. This was created to educate healthcare professionals about pharmaceutical industry marketing practices and to provide tools for accessing unbiased sources of information about prescription drugs. It was funded through a settlement. It came through our Department of Justice with the Warner-Lambert Pharmaceutical Company, who violated state consumer protection laws when promoting the drug Neurontin for off-label use. And the goals of the program was to educate health professionals at all levels of training about the drug development and approval process, making health professionals aware of pharmaceutical industry marketing practices, assisting them in the knowledge and skills to evaluate those marketing practices, and provide examples and strategies for existing sources of drug information, such as our evidence-based reviews done by the Health Resources Commission, for accessing unbiased sources of information. We partnered with the Oregon State University's School of Pharmacy to develop several programs. One was we went out detailing, sort of an academic detailing, where we conducted in some health clinics where we went and had someone describe some information, and you'll see in your packet there's sort of a one with a bunch of little diagrams on it, some information about their prescribing habits, and talked about that particular type. I think in most cases it was mental health drugs, and then we evaluated them 6 months later on whether that having that sort of information from a non-biased source about those drugs would change their prescribing behavior. Unfortunately, we couldn't get Dr. Haxby and his co-workers at OSU to here today, but they're evaluating the results of that testing. Second is we presented 13 didactic lectures around the state. We had three different physicians go to medical staff meetings and other clinics and talk about the same sort of information. And then thirdly, the one I want you to I'll have Dr. Pass go over is we've set up a web-based tutorial. It is now available for continuing medical education for providers, and it talks about pharmaceutical marketing practices and also how to interpret them and the evidence that we have from the literature about those, as well as where are some sources to get that non-biased information. And then I'll just add that you'll be seeing some ads in your question about getting consumer awareness is we have some public service announcements, or the fancy word for them is PEP, I guess, public education programs, that are going to be out on the air talking about evidence-based prescribing that should be coming out soon. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Pass.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chair Greenlich and members of the committee. I have culled slides from which you should have in front of you from 2.5 hours worth of lecture time down to about a 20-minute presentation.
Please introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dr. Smith did that, but I will do it again. Dr. Pass, David Pass, I'm the director of the Health Resources Commission for the state of Oregon. And as background, I also was in private practice anesthesiology for 20 years. I've been with the Health Resources Commission for about 2 years now. So I apologize for that. I have about 3 minutes to do 20 minutes worth of work, so if I do lose you, please jump in as far as keeping up with my slides. this is culled from two of those lectures that Dr. Smith mentioned, and basically the main one that I'll address has to do with conflicts of interest, and in the case we're sort of drilling down on presenting information on financial conflicts of interest. There's a couple of slides after the initial sort of introductory and disclaimer language that talk about financial conflicts of interest and the different types of financial conflict of interest. Again, they're the same figures we've heard before, where the pharmaceutical industry spends somewhere between $30 and $50 billion in 2005, and promotional costs are approximately $12,000 per practicing physician. There's lots of sociological evidence that shows that gifts and financial conflicts of interest have been shown to unconsciously distort an individual's notion of fairness and objectivity in favor of self-serving decision-making. The bias is unconscious and unintentional, even when the individual is made aware and giving instructions for management of those issues. The next five slides, which start with COI and psychological rationalization, illustrate in various ways that most prescribers don't feel that they are influenced by gifts and financial remuneration that they are given. However, they do seem to think that their colleagues are influenced, which is an interesting disconnect. I won't actually go.
That's the way we are too.
Yeah. I'll try and. I don't really have time to go into the specifics of that. But if we jump ahead about five slides to the one that starts with influence on physician behavior, these next few is where I'll spend most of my time. The first one, which has the two graphs at the top, basically a group of physicians participated in an all-expense-paid trip to a resort either in the Caribbean or on the West Coast. A survey of those physicians who attended those particular activities after they returned from them showed on a survey result 8 out of 10 and 9 out of 10 times that they did not feel that the prescribing prescribing behavior would be influenced. However, drug A had an approximate 10-fold increase in prescriptions afterwards, and drug B as much as 4.5-fold. Increase in prescriptions afterwards. Moving to the next slide, again, trying to keep up time-wise. This basically is a different thing. It basically is a case control or retrospective study that was, and all of these are cited. You have the references on your slides in case you want to look at any of that specifically. A case control, so a retrospective study was done in JAMA in 1994, which compared physicians who had made formulary approval requests to a random selection of physicians who hadn't made any requests. The response rate on the survey was very high at 88%, and basically physicians who made formulary drug requests were 13 times more likely to have met with a drug rep in the previous year and almost 20 times more likely to have accepted money to attend or speak at that company's symposia or conduct research for that company than physicians who made no requests. Further analysis also suggested that physicians were 1.7 to 5 times more likely to make formulary requests for drugs produced by the specific companies that they had met or received money from compared to other companies. And if you move on to your next slide, basically this was about residents who were treated to an industry-sponsored grand rounds, and basically for and it was basically on the subject of treatment for Lyme disease. And for two of the four presented cases afterwards, presented to those residents, the ones who attended the sponsored grand rounds were 5 to 8 times more likely to recommend the sponsor's parenteral antibiotic as treatment of choice compared to residents who were not in attendance. The residents who didn't attend were significantly more likely to recommend the scientifically preferred treatment option compared to those who did. And yes, the inference is that the drug they were detailed on was not the scientifically preferred medication. If we move on to the next one, an article in JAMA in 2000 sort of does a summary of this. It was done by Ashley Wazana in, like I said, 2000 to supply supporting data which shows interactions with the pharmaceutical industry leads to decreases in generic drug prescribing and increasing costs, and they actually use the term increase in irrational prescribing. How prevalent is it if we move on to the next slide? The answer is that, as you've heard, it's very prevalent. As many as 94 to 95% of physicians have accepted gifts or some sort of financial remuneration from these companies. The vast majority of it is things like drug samples and food or beverages in the workplace. And I know we've heard a little testimony on drug samples. I have a little more, but I may not have time for it.
You're having fun. You're at 5 minutes now.
I have a ton more, but yeah, I can stop whenever you'd like, sir.
How about now?
Okay. I told you I couldn't do it in 5 minutes.
But you do have the slides to show some, and this is available up on the web for the whole. And if you're a physician, you can get 1.5 credit hours for looking at it.
Actually, this is two. This is two. You get free.
How about an attorney? Can
where do you disclose that?
I called these sets, but. And the CMA is free.
Any questions?
One quick question.
Yeah, no, please. Any questions?
It says on, the slides aren't numbered, even a few minutes of contact can impact prescribing. So
yes, sir.
Then essentially the gifts are just one piece. Detailing should be eliminated from the practice site, period.
Yeah, actually, there are some systems that do outlaw detailing and provide instead their own pharmacists from providing the information that
and that would be good in a rural setting. If the provider doesn't accept these detailers in, the drug samples don't show up, and our patients that utilize drug samples don't get them and don't get the drugs.
Right. You're the one that proposes this as an alternative, certainly not the bill.
Excuse me?
The bill certainly wouldn't propose that as an alternative. You're the one that proposed.
No, I'm reading the slide.
Right.
So I'm saying you would support just banning it altogether. And I'm saying we're hammering the pharmaceutical company, but it's the pharmaceutical companies out there hawking a pair of shoes, essentially. It's the buyer. I mean, it's the physicians that are held to a higher standard. And the physicians, I believe, are the ones that should make the moral stand.
And nurse practitioners, too.
Well, no, they're without fault. Okay. It should be the onus of the physician to make these decisions as opposed to, I don't know. To me, this really is flip. This is reverse in where the responsibility lies.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Maurer, I think there's a lot of different angles, and I think that what the Attorney General Grant has given us is some ways to provide education and get them to unbiased reporting. Sometimes when that detail person comes in, they're bringing in one study, and they're not bringing in the whole comprehensive view of the study. So there is a concern about what the detailing message is, but they are currently often tied to get recipient of the samples in order to be able to, it's quid pro quo. We won't leave the samples.
And if I may just add one thing, there is information, Chair Greenlake, Representative Maurer, there is information in those slides about samples, what actually really happens to them, and what their influence is on prescribing behavior.
Representative Thompson?
To continue that line, we have an amendment in this bill, I believe, that exempts samples but I think there's compelling information here that samples are part of the problem. $18 billion in 2005. Are you advocating that we discontinue samples from physicians' offices? I mean, that...
Representative Greenlick, Representative Thompson. I don't think I'm allowed to advocate because of my position with the state. However,
are your slides advocating?
My slides might seem to suggest that that if one were to look at them, that the medications that are given as samples rarely reach the intended target audience and alter prescribing behavior to a less desirable prescription milieu, if you will. I'm trying to be very careful.
I think the real issue in this is the extent to which we rely on odd ways to provide health care for people who don't otherwise have access to health care.
It's kind of where I'm getting at. It, I don't question what the bills are trying to do. I'm not sure if we're there yet. I mean, we make an issue out of coffee cups and pens, but here I see $18 billion in drug samples in 2005. Coffee cups and pens do not come to $18 billion. So where does the influence happen? What's the relationship, and how do you get at that?
Bill 2468, I need to point out, doesn't ban anything.
That's true.
All Bill 2468 does is provide disclosure.
And this is part of that.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Yes.
I just want to point out that that's true for both bills. Thank you.
Yep.
It's true for both
You're
bills.
Here.
Just disclosure. I'm here.
Yeah. Thank you. I'd like to call Keith Dubinerich, please. Did I get that close? Was that close?
Close, but not quite.
Oh,
Chair Greenlee. Keith Dubinerich, Special Counsel for the Attorney General. Representative Mauert.
Dubinerich. Oh, that's a V, not an R. I got
Correct.
It. Okay. Yes, thank you for coming.
The Department of Justice and the Attorney General are in favor of full transparency and full disclosure. And let me give you an example of an area where we find it would be helpful to know the more about the relationship between the pharmaceutical and medical device companies and physicians. We find we have a lot of problems in what's called off-label marketing, and that's the manufacturer telling the physician about how to use a drug in a manner that is not approved by the FDA. By more disclosure and more transparency, we believe we'll learn more about those marketing practices, which are illegal. And therefore, we are very much in favor of doing whatever can be done to restore confidence in the pharmaceutical and the medical device community. To mix metaphors, we believe that sunshine in this area is the best disinfectant. Specifically regarding House Bill 2376-2, we believe that it contains some very strong enforcement mechanisms and therefore support that bill as it's written. We would be more than happy to continue to work with the sponsor of the bill. We believe that there may be a few housekeeping things that could be worked on, but we certainly are in favor of having disclosure. And Vice Chair Maurer, in response to one of your questions, we would be in favor of expanding the disclosures to include nurse practitioners and possibly other healthcare participants, because they too are very important in the decision about what kind of treatment regimen a patient undergoes. So if you're going beyond physicians, you're obviously increasing the number of people that need to report the information that has been provided to them and the remuneration that they've received. I have no further information. If the committee has any questions, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
You have a fiscal on it that has come from...
There is a fiscal that relates to the original bill, 2376. I am not aware of a fiscal regarding 2376-2.
I knew that. Yes. Okay. Are there any questions?
And Mr. Chair, I do have a conflict of interest here. My wife is a nurse practitioner.
That's why I was kidding.
Yeah.
So. Didn't mean to pick on her.
No, that's fine.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your work. and you all help to guide the Dash 2s, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Good. Thank you very much. Mr. Gardner, Mr. Holt? These are the only two scheduled witnesses who are opposing the bills at the moment. I mean, the only ones that have signed up. Doing good, I think, yeah. Jim, why don't we give you guys 5 minutes each?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm here today appearing on behalf of the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA. PhRMA is a trade association that represents the majority of the companies that discover, develop, and yes, market the prescription drugs used in the United States and elsewhere in the world. I would like to preface this by saying that it is with great respect for the committee and the chair that I come here in opposition to these bills today, and I wanted to also go through, particularly for those who were not members of the committee last session, a little bit of history, because we were privileged to actually reach an agreement with the chair and with the committee on a bill that took the approach of actually prohibiting certain practices that conflicted with the Office of Inspector General's guidelines and with the PhRMA Code of Conduct. That bill made it out of this committee, made it into Ways and Means, and unfortunately, even though times were a little bit better there, and even though Representative Greenlick and I both supported that bill in Ways and Means, it simply didn't survive the process. So it was an approach that that we actually found superior in terms of a of a prohibition on the practices that I think have been the topic of much of the discussion today. We think that things have changed a lot in recent years, due in part to societal pressure and in part to two significant actions that have occurred. The first was the adoption by all the major drug companies, the endorsement of what is called the Code on Interaction with Healthcare Professionals. Yes, it is a voluntary code, but it is, I can assure you, adhered to and enforced internally by all of the companies that that PhRMA represents. The second is a set of Office of Inspector General guidelines, Office of Inspector General of the HHS, the federal HHS, and those apply to any companies that sell products for use in the Medicaid and the Medicare system. And so theoretically, those two are optional, but every one of the companies sells products into that market. And so the OIG guidelines for them are in effect what they must abide by. One of the concerns that we have with the language of the Dash 2 amendment is, first, its effect on clinical trials. And Mr. Chairman, you mentioned a clinical trial situation that had developed. But right now, we believe there are approximately 2,900 clinical trials going on in the state of Oregon. And I would suggest to you that those are beneficial to Oregonians in at least two ways. First, participants in those trials, patients, benefit by getting access to products and technologies that may be just on the horizon. there's another bill coming through the process some of you may know about, which would, in effect, mandate that health insurers provide usual and customary care to people who are participants in clinical trials, so that there's not a discouragement of participating in those trials. But second, those trials are beneficial to the Oregon economy, to practitioners and to others who participate in them. And I wouldn't suggest that passage of this bill would eliminate Oregon as a venue for clinical trials, but our folks who study such things clearly feel it would be a discouraging factor, and I question whether that's something that you'd want to undertake at this juncture in the economic cycle. The second issue is equally serious, but a little more subtle, and it has to do with the unintended consequences of this bill. Several years ago, a senior executive at Oregon Health Sciences University asked me in a kind of candid conversation, what would it take to bring a major branch or even a headquarters of one of the pharma member companies to Oregon? And I responded, I think it's highly unlikely that a Wyeth or a company like that would uproot from New Jersey and move to Oregon. But what is more likely to happen is that the venture capital arms of those firms might find a promising biotech firm, a promising startup here, and maybe do a seed round, maybe do a second round, and essentially grow a biotech firm that starts in Oregon and might have the possibility of becoming a major company, much as the companies in the Bay Area or the companies in the Seattle area have done. And here's what I'm really concerned about this bill. If you look at the language in the bill covering the transfer of value or items of value, I think what we all have in mind are when you read that is a free meal or a dinner out or something like that. But unfortunately, it's broad enough.
Valuable consideration
that it would include a venture round by the venture capital arm of a pharmaceutical company in an Oregon startup if the CEO or a key executive of that company were a physician, and that is often the case. It is often the case that the CEO or major shareholder in that company, I don't know if that can be fixed. I doubt that it can.
That would need to be disclosed. Yeah.
Disclosure is the problem, though, because those investments typically are covered by very strict non-disclosure agreements. They're highly competitively sensitive, particularly in the venture capital arena. And it would be, and as Mr. Holt will talk later from that particular perspective, it would be a real turnoff.
Sooner, rather than later.
And I want to leave you with that thought, and also with the thought that there is another way. That other way is represented by Senate Bill 649, which is in the process. It's what we call the attestation approach, and what it basically does is require any drug manufacturer or wholesaler doing business in the state of Oregon to essentially fill out a sworn statement, file it with the state that they are abiding by the applicable industry code, which is the pharma code I just gave you. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt here today on behalf of Eisai, which is a small biopharma company which produces therapies for early-onset Alzheimer's and a number of specialty treatments for small, hard-to-treat populations. Currently, Eisai has at least four orphan drugs products in the market. For instance, Banzel, which is has a total population globally with the condition of a rare form of epilepsy of fewer than 100,000 people. Just to give you some idea of the scale with which my client is operating versus a very large company might be. Eisai is part of a bioscience industry that contributes, according to Eco Northwest, and I've distributed a copy of the study recently completed by the Bioscience Association of Oregon, about 14,000 fairly well-paying jobs in Oregon that contribute about $800 million in biotech workers' personal incomes to the state. It's a very important industry that's doesn't get a lot of attention here. ASI complies, of course, with the Office of Inspector General guidelines, which have the effect of regulation and law in terms of dealing with Medicaid and Medicare programs, and is a signatory to the pharma guidelines, which were recently revised. ASI is a biotech and a pharma company. And I'll tell you that the guidance internally at ASI, as I'm aware at many other companies, is tighter than what the law requires, and there is one word for people who violate the policies. It's fired. Companies deal very harshly with those who violate policies in regard to interactions with physicians. As a company engaged in providing treatments for rare diseases, it's particularly important for my client to have relationships with physicians and other providers in order to gain feedback on highly specialized products and to identify unmet medical needs. The company's communications with physicians and others by federal law have to be what's called fair balance. That is, you can't just talk about the good news. You have to talk about the downsides and the side effects as well. And those discussions have to be clinical. The guidelines, most recently revised, ban all those cute little teddy bears and stuff that you recently saw. In fact, most of what you heard about in the prior testimony hasn't been allowed for years by any company. There is no longer, with the new guidelines, any allowance for instance, individual entertainment of a prescriber. It's just not allowed. The relationships we do have are more of a consultative basis, where we may have people on an advisory board in a highly specialized area to provide us with feedback on, you know, where treatments are working, where there needs to be further development, and that sort of thing. There's a very strong concern that my client has in regard to the exposure of intellectual property in both of these bills. They were both quite plainly, with the amendments, require public reporting of highly sensitive information, such as Mr. Gardner noted, investments in biotech startups, preclinical research projects, and the like. Our competitors would just love to gain insights into that sort of thing. They would like to know where we're headed, where we're thinking about heading. It might interest them in trying a hostile takeover. It might interest them in funding research of their own to get a leg up on us, and all other sorts of competitive activity. These bills, in terms of effect on investment in biotechnology, are about like putting a do not disturb sign at the Oregon border. It is that damaging to the climate. You know, we understand, and the industry, I think, and certainly my client has responded to the criticisms of the industry over the years. Things are much different now than they were even two or three, 4 years ago in the way that representatives are allowed to interact with physicians. I would say I think you would be very pleased if you were to see what sort of internal regulation there is of this sort of activity. And so I would see these bills as really casting to a large degree aspersions on the industry as a whole, when it's really not necessary. The interactions and the relationships that the industry has with my client has with experts are very important to patient care, and we would like them to be able to continue but not have to expose them to all of our competitors. And with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Garrett, I think you were first.
Thank you. This is a question for either of you. The venture capital problem, I think, is a legitimate concern. And I'm wondering, in the other states, and I forgot how many there are, that have moved in direction of requiring disclosure, have any of them dealt with this aspect of it in a way that is satisfactory that we could probably take a look at?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, I'd have to investigate that, and I'd be glad to do that.
Thank you.
My understanding is that research at the Mayo Clinic hasn't dried up as a result of...
Mr. Chair, it's not so much the research issue as the VC issue and the protection of the, you know, NDAs and IP that goes with that.
So you guys don't have a problem with the research piece of it?
Yeah, I think we probably do, but we have... I was just focusing specifically on that particular aspect because it kind of leapt out at me.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, venture capital is unknown. but on research.
Yeah, if I may, on the research question, you know, as noted in prior testimony, it's more or less the standard when folks present at scientific conferences that they disclose where their funding has come from. Once it reaches that point, the concern here is when it's before it gets presented in a public scientific forum. We don't really want our competitors to be aware of what we're up to.
So you prohibit your investigators from presenting in scientific forum because of the relationship?
No, that is, Mr. Chair, that's not what I said.
Okay. Gotcha. Any more? Representative Tomei?
Sure, unless there's somebody else in the committee who has questions. Do you have other?
Go ahead.
Okay. Jim, it's interesting seeing you again. I think we were probably in the same room 4 years ago.
2 years ago, Mr. Chair.
I remember this conversation 4 years ago, and I was looking at the date on this code, and as I recall at that time, you thought it was unnecessary because the code of ethics would eliminate any need for this bill, and yet as I look at the current statistics that we have now, that the issues really have not died, and that the amount of money that is spent on going to physicians and other healthcare professionals has not declined at all. It's certainly increased. So my position is that I don't think that this has really had the effect that perhaps you promised that it would 4 years ago.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I think that the studies that you may be referring to may include as marketing expenses sampling. And certainly the anecdotal evidence or the testimonial evidence, if you will, that I have seen with regard to the internal compliance programs that Tom referred to indicate that there has been a dramatic change over the last 3-4 years in terms of precisely that kind of activity.
That's interesting. I would be interested in seeing statistics that show that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Cannon?
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Jim. You have described again this code and said that the FIRMA members are sort of signatories to it. However, I'm looking at a list of the U.S.'s largest pharmaceutical manufacturers and a list of FIRMA members. They don't entirely aligned. So even if we were to accept that this code gets us far enough, it does not regulate in a voluntary way the conduct of every pharmaceutical manufacturer, not even every large pharmaceutical manufacturer and seller in this country. Is that not the case?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, I think that's a fair point, and that's why we would suggest that you take a careful look at Senate Bill 649, which would essentially mandate that any drug manufacturer or wholesaler doing business in the state of Oregon subscribe to, sign up for, and we had actually put in there, went in the draft that was used, a specific reference to this code. LC made it a kind of a generic reference, but I think that would get at precisely the issue you've identified.
And a second question, Mr. Chair. You, in your testimony, suggested that by passing this legislation, we might have a chilling effect on clinical trials in this state. And it's a pretty strong claim to make, and it's a pretty, I'll just leave it at that. Do you have any evidence that states that have adopted codes like this have reduced the access of their patients to clinical trials?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, I believe that there is a basis for that that's evidence-based, but I will see what I can do to get that information for you.
I appreciate that. Thanks.
Representative Thompson and Maurer.
A couple of points. First of all, I concur with Mr. Gardner on the venture capital part. That is going to be a very serious problem. I have confidentiality agreements with two startup venture groups that if I or any member of the group divulges information about the project, the venture capital, which in this case would be out of San Francisco, evaporates.
It's we could highly certainly get an amendment on
so
that
we,
issue, couldn't
we? Need to deal with that. The other question that still bothers me, and I don't know what happens in the physician's office, but just yesterday I was at a pharmaceutical meeting in Portland. Pharmaceutical companies had no giveaways. there were two recruitment companies there that were giving away flashlights and chapstick, but the pharmaceutical companies were giving away brochures.
Neither of these bills. Let's get off this
red herring.
But there
was nothing to disclose, you know.
Well, then there's nothing to disclose. But neither of these bills deal with flashlights and pen lights. They deal with disclosure of financial arrangements.
I'm just wondering if we're creating a bureaucracy to collect information that's not there.
Well, if it's not there, it's really easy to collect.
Well, then could we amend it to sunset this thing? We'll try it. If we were to pass it, put a sunset on it, and if there's no information that's of any use, we won't continue doing it.
We could put in a legislative attempt. If nobody makes any disclosure legally, then it will go away. I'd be happy to put that in legislative attempt. I suspect there may be at least one.
I think something we need to look at before we create something that is going to bog down somewhere with a lot of paperwork.
I have some pens left over from a prior life. If
I do too.
Representative Mauer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Actually, no, it's as of a week ago. I'm no longer conflicted in that regard.
Come to the light. You're not doing anything useful anymore now that you're not providing patient care.
Well, no, I never did. I watched my wife do it. But, you know, my question is, the use of pharmaceuticals, I believe, the growth is declining. And as opposed to what was testified, that it's growing at 18% a year, can you provide this this committee with the latest on growth of the pharmaceutical and how much that is a part of the spending dollar? And you know, it is so easy to vilify your industries. You know, all you do is you can go after one big guy, you go after Walmart, we don't go after Bi-Mart in this state. But you go after the big boys because they're a single target and perceived to have a lot of money, and quite frankly, you do. But it still gets back to, it's the physician or the nurse practitioner or the prescriber is the one that's being influenced by this action, and if they don't like it, then they can stop doing it.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Mauer, thank you for the question. Be happy to provide you with some data, but my recollection is that ever since Medicare started keeping the statistics back in the mid-60s, that drug spending as a percentage of the healthcare dollars hovered around 10 to 11%, give or take. Of course, healthcare costs as a whole have gone up, and those costs have gone up with them.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Mauer, I think we can get that data to you from there's good charts from the Kaiser Family Foundation, I think, which would be viewed as an unbiased source.
Also good charts in the census. Okay. There are a few more questions, and we'll try and get them. There are at least two more witnesses. We've got seven more that want to come on. We're not going to make that. We'll open this back up again when we get it, but there are at least a couple that I know have come, and I would like to get them on. So we will now have Harker, Kotek, and Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gardner, I think, don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you suggested that there was it was not empirical evidence. It was
anecdotal, I think, is the way I refer to it, which is, but there may be empirical evidence, and that's what I'm going to seek.
But there was anecdotal evidence to indicate that X, Y, and Z had not happened as a consequence of this passage of similar legislation in other states.
It has not entirely shut off clinical trials, Mr. Chair, Representative Harker. That is for sure. What I don't know is whether, and I think the question had to do with had it had any detrimental effect on research dollars in the state of Minnesota?
Correct.
And I don't know the precise answer to that, but I'm going to try to find that out. But
that would be really handy, because I don't think anecdotal evidence has place here.
Mr. Chair,
we have an abundance of empirical data showing that in the time frame that you referenced, the last 4 to 5 years, that there have been impacts on prescription rates, et cetera.
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, I agree, and I will endeavor to find that evidence.
It would be critical. Thanks.
Representative Kotek.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
President Bruin.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, as part of your ongoing homework project,
your assignment.
And I'm not looking for an answer here because it's slightly out of the scope of directly what this bill is, these two bills are trying to do, but it's following a little bit on Representative Maurer's homework assignment. With the declining cost of pharmaceuticals, I would like to know if and if it's true how much the U.S. pharmaceutical industry subsidizes the rest of the world who have put limitations both on their ability, their marketing efforts, as well as the bottom line cost of drugs. Because it's my sense that, you know, yes, we all agree that pharmaceuticals need to make a profit, and it's my sense that we tend to make a lot of profit in the United States to make up for the fact that they don't make profits anywhere else in the world. And without that R&D incentive, the whole world loses. But I'll leave that closed-ended for...
I suppose part of the question is, why would they bother to go to the rest of the world if they're losing money? I mean, why not just focus here where they can make money?
I don't think they're losing money.
I'm sorry.
I don't think they're losing money. I mean, why would any doctor see a Medicare patient or a Medicaid patient? Because they're losing money on each and every time they see one of those patients, but yet they continue to do it.
Because doctors have a professional obligation, and the pharmaceutical industry hasn't done much to display any kind of professional obligation, I think. I think they're not losing money in other places is the real answer. I don't know if they're losing money.
The question is more, it's not whether losing or profiting as much as profiting to the point that satisfies the R&D requirement.
Well, I suppose the important question, this would be a great question for us to have in a seminar here. And
well, that's why I said it was a homework, not for discussion here.
Why should the United States subsidize the rest of the world if it is? And in fact, why would a Swiss drug company expect to be subsidized in the United States rather than in Switzerland? Because they can get it because we're stupid enough to let them, is the answer to that question, and Switzerland's not. At any rate, thank you both.
Thank you.
There are at least two. I'd like to call Dr. Chiodo and Mark Gibson. Is there anybody else for whom it would be a problem to come back a different day? If there is, I will hear them now, because I really appreciate citizens coming down to testify. So if it's going to be a problem for anybody else on the list to come back the next time, Jim, in front of you. Come on up. Jim, come on up also. Please. Gary, you want to start?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Gary Chiodo, and I'm here to offer Oregon Health and Science University's support for both of these House bills, 2376 and 2648. I'm the Chief Integrity Officer at OHSU. And the Associate Director for the OHSU Center for Ethics in Healthcare, and I'm a tenured professor.
Gary, are you speaking formally for the university in this case?
I am speaking formally for OHSU and presenting their position, Mr.
Great.
Chair.
Thank you very much.
OHSU does have some experience in this area. We, in 2001, implemented policies and procedures for mandatory disclosure for all of our employees. That's about 12,000 employees. For all of their outside activities that are related to their position at OHSU. So if they're doing anything with an outside company related to healthcare, they must disclose it, and it goes through a review and approval process. To pile on to that, we then implemented separate policies and procedures for disclosure and management of general conflicts of interest in research, clinical conflicts of interest, executive conflicts of interest, and then finally institutional conflicts of interest. All of those have separate review, disclosure, management processes. Some of them have standing committees that are charged with review and management. One of the things that we found over the past couple of years in the United States is that if we depend on disclosure just from the provider side, that frequently fails. And some of the recent events that we've read about from very esteemed faculty in Ivy League universities shows that they don't always fully disclose. That's one of the reasons that it's very important to have bills like this that require disclosure from the other side, from the corporate or industry side. The other thing that these bills will achieve is that while in an institution like OHSU or a university setting, we can have institutional policies mandating disclosure and management, if you go to providers in an individual provider situation, a private practice, a small provider practice, there are no such institutional policies that are required. So unless you have a mandatory disclosure from the other side, from the industry side, you really don't approach those. I'm not going to recite for you all of the various studies that have been done by professional organizations and a couple of the government actions on this issue. I would summarize that the professional organizations that have studied this, and I've listed just a few of them in my written testimony, the theme from what they have found is one of increased disclosure, increased transparency. What is disclosed belongs to the public, and it should be readily available on a web page. They should not have to file a FOIA request to get that information. And that gifts should either be limited or eliminated, because, in fact, even small gifts are known to influence prescribing practices. The two government studies that I'd reference, well, one's a study and the other is a bill, is what came from the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, or MedPAC, which again advocates for increased disclosure by drug and device companies and that the data is public. The Grassley Amendment, I think you're all familiar with, and in reviewing the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2376, it appears that a lot of the language in Dash 2 came right out of Grassley. And that is that's a strong recommendation because it gets Oregon on the same level playing field with all of the other states, and it takes care of a lot of the issues related to intellectual property and what might happen in other states. We're all playing by the same rules. OHSU is requesting some your consideration for some modifications, and I'll go over them rapidly. First of all, the data submitted by industry should reside in a publicly accessible database. And I think that's what Grassley recommends as well as the MedPAC recommendations. The disclosures are needed by patients, students, and institutional administrators who are charged with oversight and management of financial conflicts of interest. Second, the intended industry disclosure should first go to the provider who
needs... Gary, are these in your written testimony?
They are.
Okay. Well, we'll pick them up and look at them for amendment possibilities.
Okay. One final point I'd make is that I want to remind you or call your attention to Senate Bill 10, which went into effect in 2007, which places all of us who are public providers in a different situation in that we have to disclose and cannot accept more than $50 from any outside agency, which for us at OHSU has translated to policy that's a $0 limit, which I think is probably what we should be aiming for.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a quick question?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Chiodo. Dr. Chiodo, does OHSU do clinical trials?
We do.
With this follow-up, would either of these bills affect those clinical trials at all?
Chairman Greenlick and Representative Tamai, either of these bills would not adversely affect clinical trial performance, and nor would the Grassley Amendment.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mark Gibson. I'm the Deputy Director of the Center for Evidence-Based Policy at Oregon Health and Science University. They're much too wise up there to let me speak for them, so these comments are my own only. In the interest of brevity, having learned a long time ago that quite often the longer you talk, the more votes you lose, I'll just say that I'm here in support of the Dash 2 amendments for House Bill 2376. I think that the principles here are very simple. You've heard them reiterated a number of times, and that is simply that when you're trying to make decisions about your health, you should know who the person that's giving you advice is working for. And I think it's no more complicated than that. If you're a physician trying to decide what you're going to do in your practice, you should know who the person that's giving you advice is working for. And similarly, you should know as a patient who your physician or healthcare clinician is working for besides yourself. To a couple of the issues that were raised earlier in a question, I think that this legislation, if the Minnesota experience is any indication, this legislation really does get you to the point where there can be a real impact. If the experience there, I mean, I think that folks in that state were stunned by the results of the disclosure in their state to learn exactly how much money was going to physicians and other practitioners, healthcare practitioners in their state from industry sources. And I think it was useful for those patients and those and the public there to understand the level of that. The final point I would make is that there's nothing about these bills that that should diminish our healthcare practitioners in any way or their motivations. Certainly they're among the highest trained and most highly trained professionals that we have in our society. But the fact is we have good research that shows they don't really appreciate the effect that this can have on them. And I think that one other really important use for all of this would be for healthcare practitioners themselves, who in the normal course of business may not be able to understand or may not recollect the full amount of the kind of material that comes their way and the kind of value that comes their way from some of these marketing efforts would be able to go online and actually evaluate their own behavior based on these disclosures. Thank you.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Davis, representing the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, United Seniors of Oregon, the Oregon Consumer League, and the Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans. We come here today to support 2376 and to thank Representative Tomei for her continued efforts for consumers. And we are here to support what is a good piece of legislation. It's about creating transparency and disclosure. And we're not trying to deny the right to market new and current drugs, but the process should be fair and not give advantage to those who have the means to pay for expensive gifts and trips. We believe that the money spent on marketing certain drugs, and I think we're all aware of a lot of examples that have been overkill and created bias towards certain drugs and drew the attention away from equally beneficial and oftentimes less expensive alternatives. Frankly, I would like to see part of the money used for marketing on what would be real education of both health professionals and consumers. These are important issues to us in the senior community because 30% of all the drugs purchased are purchased by seniors. We also are looking at about one-third of our senior hospitalizations are drug-related problems. We truly believe that more effort should be spent on drug safety education in the community. But HB 2376 is a good step forward. It creates more transparency and hopefully fairness in the marketing practices and would ultimately benefit our consumers. One final thought. Again, I would like to see additional requirements around fair and unbiased community-based and evidence-based education for health professionals and drug safety education for consumers, particularly the underserved populations. That would save a lot of lives if we did that. So thank you for your time, and I certainly support 2376.
Jim, thank you very much. Yes.
If I could, question to Dr. Chioda. I wondered, and I didn't see it addressed in your testimony, how do you deal with the issue of samples and detailing?
OHSU, prior to even our conflict of interest policies, has a clinical policy that does not allow free samples. There are ethical reasons for that. One is that the free samples tend to be the most expensive, latest, greatest blockbuster drug, and once the patient uses them, they can't afford them. There's a safety issue related to it as well, and that's that we've all heard of drug recalls. If the medication has come through a pharmacy and there's a drug recall, the pharmacy database can immediately find out who received that drug and notify the people. If you've handed out free samples, you can't do that.
I mean, if you have an electronic health record, you can do a data query on your electronic health record. And I would assume that a large organization such as OHSU has an electronic health record that would allow you to query your prescriptions, because doctors, physicians, providers should note what they've given to their patients. So I would inquire.
What about detailing? Is that an issue there?
Okay. I'm answer it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kennemeyer, detailing is an issue. It's certainly an ethical issue, because the detailing is usually, again, for the most expensive and latest and greatest drug.
So is detailing allowed at OHSU?
Yeah, detailing is not allowed at OHSU. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I'm going to... Thank you both very much. I'm going to close the public hearing, and if we'll hang on just a minute, I want to open up a work session on 2376 for the purpose of adopting the Dash 2 amendments. That will allow us to get a fiscal on Dash 2, so we know where we are with that.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to HB 2376.
Is there any discussion?
Be adopted.
Discussion? Any objections? The Dash 2s are in. I'll close the work session on 2376. And I guess I closed both public hearings. If I didn't, I'll close the public hearing on 2468 and 2376. And thank you very much. And
thank
Vice
you,
Chairs will.
Thanks for coming.
Regather as soon as possible. We're adjourned. Thank you all very much for coming. I really